This is Sean Kennedy. I'm the Editor-in-Chief of the American Journal of Nursing. And today is April 21st, and we're well into the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States and in the world. And today I'm speaking with Dr. Beverly Malone. Bev is the CEO of the National League for Nursing, an organization for nurse faculty and promotes excellence in nursing education. NLN, as it's known, has over 40,000 members and from 1,200 schools. Is that, am I correct? Those numbers fairly correct,
yes,
Bev?
Yes, you are.
Yes. Great. Bev is a former ANA president. She's also former general secretary of the United Kingdom's Royal College of Nursing. And most recently, in February of 2020, Bev was named among the inaugural list of an elite group of five minority healthcare executives by Modern Healthcare. So congratulations, Bev, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk today.
Thank you so much. I'm happy. Well, I wouldn't say happy to be here, but because these are not happy times, but it's important to be here.
Right, thanks. Yes, it is a very surreal time. So would you talk a little bit about what's happening in your area in terms of what you're hearing from schools about how they have adapted and scrambled to work with students to get them through the year as they came so close to the end of the year? But could you talk a little bit about what you're hearing from what most schools were facing and how they managed?
Well, I have to say that I'm very proud of the faculty and the students who, as they face, especially those who are right near graduation and the uncertainties that all go with that. What I see faculty doing is some of them are really concerned about sending their students into the clinical area. They are not sure whether they should encourage them. They're not sure how they should do that. And then others are saying, we've got to do everything we can to keep the ball rolling. We are the supply chain, and so we need to make sure that our students keep moving forward. And we need to do everything we can to make sure they're as well prepared as we possibly can. Mm-hmm. And so issues of like clinical simulation of how they're going to get, well, how they're going to get that last area of time that they need to graduate. And if it's a capstone, maybe they can actually do it in the hospital. Maybe there can be a bridge between the hospital and the School of Nursing where faculty can still actually work with the students, but it would be with an understanding it would be a different kind of program.
Mm-hmm.
There's also some of the schools are saying they're all using their flexibility, their ingenuity, their creativity. And so clinical areas are always the biggest issue. And one of the things that schools are saying, please don't call us visitors. That when we come, students, when we come, we are not guests. We are there to work, and we are there to be with you and with the patients that are there. And when a hospital or area labels them as visitors, that means they usually can't get into the clinical setting. And so some of them have been blocked out of the opportunity of getting into the clinical setting, even if it's not in one of the frontline areas.
Mm-hmm.
So that bridge between faculty, between the School of Nursing and the hospital and those in leadership at the hospital, it becomes so important about how we're bridging that relationship more than anything, I think, has come to the fore.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've been able to write some of the statements with our colleagues at NCSBN, the National Council of State Boards of Nursing, about, well, you know, how are we going to look at nursing students who are going into clinical settings, who are actually going to be, we could actually hire them into clinical settings. And that was with the VA and about 12 other organizations signed on to that you could, instead of the nurse student being a sort of outside of the system, why not invite them into the system and invite them to sign up as an employee of that system and finish the program there.
Mm-hmm.
So there are all kinds of innovative ideas about how we might actually move forward on making sure that the students get everything they need to be able to practice in a quality way,
mm-hmm.
and that the clinical areas get what they need. Those have been some of the biggest issues. But I know faculty who have written me and said, we are so concerned about the lack of PPE. We are so mm-hmm. concerned about, and that's not for my students now, that's for students that I had several years ago that are now on the front line and do not have the personal protective equipment that they need. And there's just been an incredible amount of concern and pain
mm-hmm.
about how have we prepared those nurses, in not the ones we have right in our palm and they're our students, but what have we done to those who have been prepared already, and have we sent them into an unprotected situation? And a lot of concern about that, a lot of strong feelings about that, and pain, and I would say anger and sadness, terror,
yes.
all of those things about the fact that we know that some of the students we prepared are right on that front line and having to experience those kinds of things. So I've gotten letters, emails, you know, letters these days don't occur,
yeah.
but I've gotten emails from some of my schools and colleagues saying that fact that we don't have the PPE is an incredible pain to the faculty people that prepared those students at another time.
Sure, yeah, and it's not just in the hospitals. I mean, you listen to what's happening in the nursing homes, and I spoke with a visiting nurse the other day in New York who did have personal protective equipment, but again, it's not what we were used to having, and it's kind of the crisis contingency use of personal protective equipment, and I think there's justifiable a lot of concern and anger because, you know, we're taught to be evidence-based, but the changes that happened were not based on evidence but based on supply needs. And for nurses who, as you said, are on the front line and taking the risk, it's very frightening. And I know that NLN was one of many who signed on a letter to Congress about this issue. And it's just it. I know there's a lot of advocacy happening now. It's the year of the nurse and midwife, but it's taking on a whole different tone from what I think we envisioned when it was first announced that it would be the year of the nurse and midwife. There's a lot of advocacy going on.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I mean, the advocacy going on. I know New York State Nurses Association are suing. Creating a lawsuit over the PPE, and I think there's a demonstration being planned at the White House to protest the lack of equipment. So I think the year of the nurse and midwife is turning into a totally different animal.
You know, it is, and at the same time, it's emphasizing the fact that without nurses, we really can't function in terms of a health system. And that's whether in nursing homes or whatever clinical setting you want to put,
mm-hmm.
or even a non-clinical setting, but walking through a door of your doctor's office, you know, which is something we all do at some point in time. It's not necessarily a clinical area, but that every place you go, you will meet a nurse
right.
if you're trying to get into any part of the healthcare system. And so while it's not the usual year of the nurse and not what we thought it would be.
It definitely
is. In
some
ways, it is the year. It's the year of the nurse and how important nursing is to the whole system and how we work collaboratively with our colleagues who are physicians, who are respiratory therapists, who are. And we bring all that together to make sure patients get care and they get caring as they get care.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the things that have been most impressive to me have been doing the Zoom pictures of someone transitioning and losing life, trying to just say that goodbye to their family,
mm-hmm.
and nursing trying their best to make sure that happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I also want to mention what you just talked about, the nursing homes. Amazing how the care is being delivered and how it, the same kind of courage that it takes on the front line, whether you're in a hospital, is having to happen in those nursing homes where the older adult is there and in desperate need, and one of the most vulnerable people in the system in terms of getting that virus, of being there and not knowing, and in some ways being trapped by the virus.
Mm-hmm.
And so nurses are there, and I think some of the most courageous work that's being done are being done at our nursing homes.
Yes, I would agree, because we know that even in the best of times, many nursing homes were underfunded and understaffed. And when you look at who's giving the care in nursing home, many of the people giving the care in the nursing home are women who are perhaps from other parts of the world, who don't have health insurance themselves in many instances, and women of color. So I think when you look at how these people have stepped up and continue to do their jobs, just like nurses everywhere. It's just amazing that things haven't been worse than they have been when you think about it. You mentioned one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because you are on the list of one of the five minority healthcare executives, in terms of what we know about or what we don't know about the coronavirus and how it's disproportionately affecting the Black population and brown people. Do you have any comments about that?
Yes. You know, it's more what it's those social determinants of health that have to do with where you live, where you work, and the level of position you have in the whole system, that you had to take the metro in or the bus in, and you had to be crowded with everybody else mm-hmm. along the way. Those positions that you talked about in the nursing home that some of our licensed practical nurses are taking, I mean, you're in a situation where you don't have a lot of alternatives but to use the system that you or the cards you've been dealt. And I think that there's a really heavy piece of that is carried by the Black and brown population of this country. And as a result, it means that they're one of the more vulnerable people of this society, and they are taking it, you know, someone would say on the chin, but I say no, in their lungs and in their body, and those viruses are attacking them. And when they attack them, the Black and brown people die quicker than anyone else. So it's a very, very difficult situation that all of the people in this country have to face. And I would have to say that our historically Black schools of nursing are probably some of the folks who are turning out more Black and brown nurses than anyone else in the country. I know when I used to live in North Carolina, it was sort of the common thought that the historically Black schools of nursing that were there combined graduated more Black and brown nurses than the whole country altogether.
Mm.
So I'm not sure that that's the same now, but at that time it was the case.
Mm-hmm.
And the contribution that's made by those historically Black schools of nursing can't be lost.
Right.
At the same time, you know, I know my colleagues will, in all areas, will step up, will step into their authority and say that we have got to manage this virus, because the virus really doesn't necessarily check your skin color before it attacks you. I think it had more to do, like I said, with those social determinants of health. Where you work, where you play, where mm-hmm. you sleep, where you eat, you know, those kinds of variables that put us in that vulnerable position.
Sure. I don't think it's a coincidence that the denser populations, I mean, you look at New York, and even within New York, the communities in Queens and Elmhurst and Brooklyn that have had the most surge in highest numbers of deaths and cases in the city. While the city itself has certainly had, an inordinate share, this is the first day in weeks that we've had under 500 deaths, I think. But it has been those communities that are typically where people who have settled who are, in the lower income brackets and struggling to make it on a good day. So I think that's perhaps the disparities that have becoming more evident with this virus, hopefully will become more evident to all those who are making policies as well. One can hope. You did mention quickly that there were some innovative things happen. You mentioned the University of Nebraska was doing something very unique.
Yes, I don't have a lot of details about it, but what I've heard from a Nebraskan colleague of mine is that they're actually providing free university time for schools of nursing, the School of Nursing at the University of Nebraska, that it's going to be free. Of course, you have to get in.
Sure.
And there are some criteria there that will, that's always with nursing, there's usually a long line of colleagues, of students out there, of potential students who would love to get in to nursing school. And so it's going to be a very competitive thing, of course, getting into the program. Mm. And then there's some other criteria about staying in the program. You have to keep your grades at a certain level. And I don't know all the details, but it is innovative. It does speak to what you're talking about, that not everybody has the finances to go to nursing school, and that education, there should be especially one that takes care of the country, like nursing does, that there should be some level of accommodation that would allow all of us to have the opportunity to do something as noble and as important as become a nurse. And so I'm hoping that will be, it will catch on even more than just in the middle of the country, than in just Nebraska, that we'll see it in all kinds of places.
It would be nice. I mean, there were several medical schools, NYU in New York is one that said that they would not, waive tuition for medical students. So it's nice to see that nursing is getting, at least in one state, an opportunity to also recognize the importance of nursing. And I think it's especially important. We were talking about facing shortages a while ago, but I guess one of the things I get concerned about with this is that will nurses in hospitals, given that the hospitals have not been very nurse-friendly as a whole in terms of a working environment, will more nurses leave hospital nursing and seek work elsewhere outside? I mean, we certainly do need nurses, and we want nurses in the community, and we want the care to be going there. But this pandemic shows the importance of having a well-prepared staff in hospitals. So that's one concern I have, is that will the shortage be greatly exacerbated by this pandemic, especially in hospital nurses?
Well, the shortage is the two basic issues that create the shortage and maintain this shortage are not enough clinical spaces. And not enough faculty. Those are the two primary issues. And so I'm hoping that there will be enough faculty and there will be enough clinical placements. And if not clinical placements, then we'll understand the use of stimulation, of building it into our curriculum, not just in different places. But, when I think about stimulation, I think about what I was, born and raised before simulation was the thing to do. And so all of my experiences were directly with the patient. And I think there could have been so many other opportunities for me and the patient. So the patient would have had a better chance in terms of not seeing me at my raw, but more at my more educated, at more practiced. Because what I found is that you can really practice things. And even psychiatric mental health nursing, and I'm a psych mental health nurse, you can practice that. So I think that there's a real wonderful possibility out there, and that the pandemic is giving us the opportunity to learn some things, too, and so that we don't become so over-despondent with it that we miss out on the learning and that we let go of how nurses can function at the top of their at the top of their license, at the scope of highest scope of their practice, and that it can make a difference, that wonderful compacts between the states does allow for telehealth, and telehealth is something we can use. So I'm hoping that these different learnings will be captured and used as we move forward.
Well, Bev, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out during this this very stressful time. And I wish you well and hope you and your family stay safe and that pretty soon that we can get back on track again in a safe way, of course. Thank you so much.
Well, my wish is the same to you and to all those listening. Stay safe and stay healthy.